This is Division III of the Colorado Court of Appeals. This will be, among other things, memorable because this is our last oral argument in this building. And tomorrow may be the last oral argument in the building by anybody. I don't know whether there's one Wednesday or not. But nonetheless, this closes a chapter of some 40 years. We're here to hear oral arguments in four, as I recall, four different cases, two of which are consolidated. On the 9 o'clock docket is case number 2009-CA-281, Fremling v. Saber. That is the first one on the docket, and counsel are here and ready to go, I assume. The second case on the 9 o'clock docket is Berra, B-E-R-R-A, versus Springer and Steinberg. Are counsel present in that case?
Yes.
Fine. Then we'll take that case second on the 9 o'clock docket. Let me make a brief record. Both cases are set for 15 minutes per side. There is an electronic timing system controlled by the bailiff, which will keep track of the time. There's a lighting system on the lectern, a module on the lectern with green, yellow, and red lights. During the first 10 minutes, the green light will be on. During the next 5 minutes, the yellow or orange light will be on. And when the argument's over, the red light will come on. There's a reverse countdown digital clock also on that module, which will keep you posted as to how much time you've used. If the appellant wishes to reserve time for rebuttal, you may self-discipline yourself to do that based upon the module, or you can ask me to help, and I'll do something to let you know you've reached that time. But ultimately, the reservation of that time is your responsibility. As I've indicated, you have 15 minutes. You should be advised that the division has read the briefs, read many of the authorities cited in the briefs, and one of us has been into the record. So you should assume or can assume that we're familiar with the facts, and you would indicate our advice to you, you go directly to the merits of the legal issues rather than dwell on the facts. We record the oral arguments. They're recorded digitally. They're available on the Internet shortly after the argument. There's a microphone on the lectern for that purpose. It also amplifies the sound in the room. We'd appreciate your staying at the lectern so that we can clearly pick up the argument. We sometimes use it in the preparation of an opinion. Also, there are toggle switches on the lectern on your right, one for up and one for down. If you find the lectern too high or too low, please feel free to use it, that adjustment, to make it more comfortable for yourself before you commence argument. All that said, are there any questions? Oh, lastly, but not by any means leastly, if you have any cell phones, Blackberries, iPhones, or any other thing that might go bump in the night unexpectedly, please turn it off so that it will not, if you're summoned, it will not disturb counsel or the court in the process of the conversation we are about to have. If there are no questions at this point, we're ready to proceed, sir. And as you approach the lectern, I will indicate to you that two or three perfectly good minds spent a good part of yesterday, and I don't count myself among them, struggling with the jurisdictional issues in this case, with particular regard to the orders with respect to the security. It appears that a final judgment was entered in January, early January. A subsequent judgment was entered in early February. A notice of appeal was filed immediately thereafter. That judgment was vacated by a subsequent order and a new judgment entered. And subsequent to that, one or two orders were issued with respect to the security. The appellee challenges the jurisdiction of this court over the last two orders. However, a request was made to this court to include those matters in the appeal, and that was granted by the Motions Division. So those two, at least at this point, the Motions Division has given us those orders. Now, the Notice of Appeal was, in my recollection, timely as to both the January and the February order, and perhaps with the first order following the February order. I'm not clear on the dates in my own mind. So, among other things that you may wish to discuss in your arguments this morning, both of you, I would appreciate you reserve some time, not at the end, but some time to discuss the jurisdictional matters. Now, I understand this case has already been up here once, and it was dismissed by the Merits Division within a few days of oral argument on jurisdictional issues. There may still be some jurisdictional issues, and we'd like to hear about them. That said, the time is yours, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, Robert Fishman, on behalf of the appellant and cross appellee, William Saber. I hadn't intended to address the jurisdictional issues, but that seems like a good place to start. Just to be clear, the last time we were up here on the eve of oral argument, the jurisdictional problem in the case was the trial court had not ruled on all of the substantive claims asserted by Dr. Fremling, in particular an aspect of his breach of contract claim and fiduciary duty claim. The case is remanded to the trial court. The trial court addresses those in an order dated January 5th that you refer to, Judge Roy. That is what the parties have considered to be the final judgment in this case. However, it's true that there are subsequent final judgments entered by the trial court judge that, in my mind, are of no consequence because they are vacated ultimately, and they do things that have no substantive impact on the judgment itself. It's a little curious to me as to why those orders were entered. One was prompted sua sponte by the trial court, the other at the request of Dr. Saber. But again, I think they have no, there's no substance to them. And I think, to be perfectly honest, I certainly appreciate the comments that a couple of you have waded through the record, and it's a difficult one to get through. I think that does help explain how the trial court judge that entered most of the security-related orders at issue was a little confused and did some things that, in my view, doesn't really make sense. He was not the trial judge who heard the case or the trial judge who entered the initial security orders. He comes in late. It's a difficult case to do that with. In terms of jurisdiction, I don't think that there's any question but that the appeal is perfected as to the January 5th order resolving the unresolved claims, and which is the final judgment that the parties have talked about in their papers.
Mr. Fishman, can I take you back just one step and real quickly? When you filed your amended notice of appeal, you listed both Dr. Saber and the PC as appellants. But my perception is you're really not the PC is not really an appellant here. It's in bankruptcy. The matters are stayed with respect to it?
That's correct.
Okay, so even though the notice of appeal lists the PC, this is only an appeal by Dr. Saber personally.
That's correct.
Okay.
And all I can tell you what the record...
So the judgment would, as asserted by the appellee, stand at least as respect to the PC, whatever that means after bankruptcy?
That's correct. And of course, I'm sure the court has realized this. What matters here for Dr. Saber is not only that he's held individually liable under this alter ego theory, but also that he is at first volunteers, but later is forced to pledge security on the judgment, both against himself individually and the company. So he's on the hook for the bankrupt company at this stage.
Do you normally get to volunteer and then withdraw your voluntary submission, so to speak, of security on behalf of another? Do you normally get to choose, pick and choose when you volunteer and then withdraw?
Well, I think that I don't know the answer to that question in the abstract. I think that that is not the question here, though, with respect to the deed to the home, and I assume that's what you're referring to, because here the deed is pledged as security. The trial court accepts it, and Dr. Fremling says, wait a second, I object. There's all sorts of problems with pledging your house as security. It does not protect me. Do something else, like, for example, pledging a letter of credit. And we say, you know, we're not going to fight it. We'll do exactly what you want. We will substitute a letter of credit for the deed pursuant to your objection, and we do that. And the court accepts it. So I think it isn't a case where we are, we gave you the deed, but we changed our mind now, and now we're going to give you something else. Give us that back. It's not that case. If I could back up just for a moment and address the jurisdictional question again, in our view, if the substantive judgment, the judgment on the merits, January 5th order, is perfected, timely appealed, I think it carries with it all of the security orders. I don't think a security order, whether it's entered the day after final judgment or 2 years after final judgment, is a, quote, final appealable judgment that requires a separate notice of appeal. I could find no authority that says that. Dr. Fremling has cited that. I'm sorry?
Neither could we.
Right. And so I think, and our amended notice of appeal made this clear, as do our papers, it seems to me it's like any other non-final order entered in the course of a case.
Are you agreeing, then, that the letter of credit secures the corporation?
I'm sorry?
Are you agreeing, then, that the letter of credit secures the corporation?
Sure.
Corporation's obligation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's one of the big problems here. The initial...
Well, I just ask you, are you conceding that the letter of credit, now posted, secures the judgment against the corporation?
It does, and it does so under protest by Dr. Saber and under threat by the trial court that it would draw down the original letter of credit and hold the money in an account, in trust, in the court. If Dr. Saber did not submit a renewed letter of credit on behalf of both himself and the corporation. So the answer is yes with a but.
You're seeking to vacate the order that directs that it secure the corporation.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And the arguments are different, of course, for the bond and the letter of credit. As to the letter of credit, it is true. Original letter of credit submitted by Dr. Saber's trial counsel on behalf of Dr. Saber individually and the company. Personally, I think there's absolutely no question that that was a mistake. That was a mistake. But it was made, and it's also water under the bridge in that the original letter of credit is set to expire. Then the question is, okay, what do the judgment debtors have to do to stay execution on the judgment? And our answer to that is, well, they have to come up with security that satisfies the court. And the court can impose all sorts of, quote, reasonable conditions on that security. But one thing a court can't do is say that one judgment debtor has to provide security for the judgment of a separate, independent judgment debtor. And that's
unless the judgment debtor has volunteered to do that.
Well, that raises the question, if you make a mistake once, do you have to make it a second time? And I don't see the rationale for that.
So you're to clarify your point is, the first one may have been a volunteering to stand as security for another judgment debtor, but the second one, it's clear that there's a distinction being made that I do not want to stand or present my property or letter of credit as security for the PC.
Absolutely clear on both counts, yes. And equally clear as to the bond. The deed to the house, originally pledged on behalf of both judgment debtors. When the original letter of credit is substituted for the deed, but the deed is not returned, and then the attorney's fee award is entered, rendering the original letter of credit inadequate, Dr. Saber says, you already have the deed to my house, keep it, okay, to secure the now increased judgment. But only as to me, I am not pledging that deed, repledging it for the corporation.
Is that in the transcripts or is that in the?
It's in the papers.
It's in the papers.
I mean, there's no hearing. If you look at our pleadings and I quote them repeatedly, it's absolutely and unmistakably clear. This is just for me, Dr. Saber, as an individual, not for the PC.
So this is not essentially a change of mind as to what I'm doing, but an actual, there's an intervening event which required a new security be posted.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And with respect to the claim on appeal that Dr. Fremling now makes, which is, look, the trial court didn't release the deed after the letter of credit was substituted because he knew that there was an attorney's fee award coming down the pike, and he was protecting me, and we all knew it was just a matter of time. Why let the deed go back to Dr. Saber? And that, quite frankly, is a claim that just bears no relationship to what happened below. Dr. Fremling argued consistently, I don't want to have anything to do with your house, Dr. Saber. I don't want the deed to your home to secure my judgment. If, and this also, it's a paraphrase, but the pleadings say, when you enter an award of fees in my favor, the letter of credit should be increased dollar for dollar to accommodate for that.
Counsel, I know we've asked you lots of questions on the security. Can you give us, your position about the alter ego or piercing the corporate veil action by the trial court?
Well, sure. I mean, very briefly, it was not pled. It is not a defense.
Does it need to be pled?
I don't know. I think it would be the better practice, but I understand liberal, And there's a recent case from this court in the last year where alter ego is not pled in a complaint, but it's tried by consent. The parties are arguing about it, they're citing cases, and they're introducing conflicting evidence on it. There, the court said it was properly presented, and it was not pled. So I suppose the short answer to your question is no. But I'm noting the fact that not only was it not pled, there was not a word said about it by anyone through the entire course of the proceedings, ever, pre-trial, during trial, post-trial, until the judgment is entered orally by the court, and Dr. Saber's counsel stands up and says, whose judgment against? And the court says, both of you. Goes back to the office, and he files a pleading saying, well, wait a second, the only way you can do that, the only way you can hold the individual liable for a breach of contract by a company is piercing the corporate veil, alter ego findings. But that was never a claim in this case. There was no evidence introduced on it, no arguments about it, nothing, zero.
That was a filing by Dr. Saber's counsel.
Correct.
And then responded that it wasn't an alter ego.
And then Dr. Fremling responds and says, I've never contended that this is a piercing the corporate veil case. Never argued it.
The court found that nonetheless, though, or made some sentence in there.
And then the court, in response to the argument, which is, and this I believe is a direct quote, Dr. Fremling does not now and has never argued that this is a piercing the corporate veil case, alter ego liability. That's his statement, unqualified. I quoted at least, probably four times in our papers. And nevertheless, the court says, one sentence handwritten ruling, joint and several liability because Saber's the alter ego of the company. No evidence referenced in support of that ruling. No legal standards discussed or referenced in support of that ruling.
Should we remand for that purpose?
I don't see why you would. It's a claim that was not litigated. I don't know why you would allow the court to enter judgment and explain itself and bolster a record on a question that was not only not before it, but disavowed by the party who's the beneficiary of it. So no, absolutely no reason for a remand on that. The argument on appeal now also constructed completely after the fact, not even mentioned the first time this case was on appeal, that the veil was pierced by implication prior to trial. I don't know if there's anything more I need to say about that. I mean, it seems to rest on the assumption that if you're permitted to assert counterclaims, a court is implicitly ruling on the merits of at least a portion of that claim, and not only that, ruling on the merits of a portion of that claim on a theory that nobody has mentioned.
Mr. Fishman, one thing that concerned me was that Rule 52, in cases that are tried to the court, require findings of facts and conclusions of law. And unless I'm missing something, I didn't see anything that seems to constitute findings of facts and conclusions of law written by the trial judge. But if we remanded it and we gave the judge a chance opportunity to do that, would that clarify what happened here?
There are findings of fact and conclusions of law on the substantive claims. There are none on the alter ego.
That's right.
There are none on the alter ego. But again, why do you remand to make findings of fact and conclusions of law on a claim that was not tried to the court? It makes no sense. I mean,
also in your brief, your position was there's no evidence in the record that could have supported it. So why would you remand for findings on something that would be have an insufficient record to support anyway?
Exactly, and we acknowledge
that. Am I mischaracterizing your position in your briefs?
Not at all. I mean, the position is you didn't set out to prove alter ego liability. So, of course, you didn't introduce any evidence to substantiate that. That's not where you were going with this case. Why remand? And we acknowledge, and it's discussed in the papers, sure, there's evidence introduced at trial of the sort that you often see introduced in alter ego cases, board minutes, contracts, letters. None of those things, number one, were introduced for the purpose of establishing alter ego liability. And none of those things, as it happens, support the finding that there was an abuse of the corporate form. I mean, that's just not why they're in the case. It literally was never an issue in this case until the court, in a one-sentence handwritten ruling, declared it to be so.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Because of the extended nature of the questions on jurisdiction, the bailiff should give appellee 2 minutes for rebuttal and increase appellant's time to 17 minutes. That's because we want to prolong this last session in this courtroom.
You don't know what you got till it's gone. I think that was Joni Mitchell that said that. Well, Your Honors, I'll try to pick up where the discussion left off. I am the one guy with a law degree in this room who was here for this whole thing, so I did experience it. I think what happened here is we overshot our proof. We did go into this pleading unjust enrichment, and the judgment that we got back was in unjust enrichment. Now, if you go back through the actual orders, the order that Judge Ensor originally entered.
I understand that. Did you request that he award the damages under contract rather than unjust enrichment?
No, we made a claim for unjust enrichment. That was our claim.
You never brought a breach of contract claim?
No, we did bring a breach of contract claim against Sabre PC. But we never, counsel's correct, I'm not going to lie about this, the words alter ego are not in our pleadings. They're not. Because here's the reason why.
Is it your position that you could get a judgment against Dr. Sabre on an unjust enrichment theory based upon an actual contract between your client and the corporation?
Yes, because the benefit went to him directly. That was our argument all along, is that if I could perhaps elaborate on this a bit. We have a very unusual contractual situation here when Dr. Sabre imposed the shared expenses system of compensation.
He didn't impose it. Dr. Schmidt imposed it, as I recall.
Well, APS imposed it. I think we can agree with that.
The corporation imposed it.
Yeah. But Dr. Sabre and Dr. Fremling were the ones that were left to deal with it because Dr. Schmidt retired soon after that, and the two of them were left. But when that system is in place, we have a corporation that really is a pass-through entity. That's all that it is. Income's coming in, and expenses are being attributed to each doctor, and then net income is going out to each, and nothing's being retained in the corporation.
Are you in a PC?
Pardon?
Are you in a professional corporation?
I am.
Does your professional corporation retain fees or pay out to the partners at some point, shareholders?
We pay out, but we don't split expenses myself versus my partner.
I understand
partner.
That.
I think that is the distinction.
But you don't maintain fees for capital.
No, we don't. But here, it was done on a month-by-month basis. Simply, they were taking money in, whatever the expenses were, attributing it, and the money was going back out again. And that was a system of compensation. Now, We believe that established an unjust enrichment theory of liability, and the original judgment from trial court would seem to reflect that. Our proposed findings and conclusions weren't executed. The defendants.
If that's true, why in the original judgment did the court pierce the corporate veil?
I don't think the judge did in the original judgment.
Well, I think he did, but we'll check.
Well, could I read his conclusion? He says, on Dr. Filmy's claim for unjust enrichment against Dr. Saber, the court enters judgment in favor of Dr. Fremling and against APS. I didn't draft this, as I did. Obviously, there's a misstatement there. In the amount of $171,000. And then it goes on to say, just in a handwritten entry, joint and several liability. And what happened is the defendants filed a motion saying, what do you mean by that? The other side didn't establish. They have to establish actually alter ego, and they didn't do that. And then Judge Ensor, in his revised order, basically says, yes, they did. Now, our statement about us not claiming alter ego, that's in response to their motion to alter and amend the judgment. We are trying to defend our judgment that we already had in place on unjust enrichment, because that's what that entry in the order does say. It's an unjust enrichment judgment. So we're trying to defend that. We've already got it. So I think really what happened here is I think Judge Ensor is saying, you guys proved a lot more than you think you did. You actually proved that the use of APS as this vessel rises to the point where the parties, the individual doctors, are actually parties to the contract, or Dr. Saber should be read to be one.
Even though you had disclaimed that it was alter ego, he found it was, and now you're switching horses and you're jumping on the horse that he's riding?
Yes, we are, but I think that is appropriate for us to do. Could I add in a couple things
to
show?
The same question I asked to the other counsel. Doesn't Rule 52 in a trial to the court require specific findings of facts and specific conclusions of law so that this court can review how the trial court gets to an alter ego determination? And aren't we lacking that here completely?
Well, I will agree with you that what we have from Judge Ensor is very cryptic. I mean, it's very cryptic, and it's not been fun dealing with all the post-trial things in this matter, because that's created a problem. But please understand, we were trying to defend a judgment we already thought we had in hand. In fact, we did have it in hand. We didn't move to get this thing changed. They did, saying that you can't prove unjust enrichment here. Well, we believe we did. And so now we have a judgment which is just...
I'm trying to follow your line of reasoning. I have a contract with General Motors for a car, and I pay for the car.
Yep.
General Motors didn't deliver the car. I have an unjust enrichment claim against all the shareholders of General Motors?
No.
Why not? I benefited from the fact that General Motors got $20,000, maybe nowadays $40,000, from me and didn't deliver a car. Now, all of the shareholders of General Motors benefited from that. Have an unjust enrichment claim against them?
No, you don't. I don't think General Motors is being operated the same way that APS was being operated here. I mean,
what's the problem with the operation? Just the fact that it took in fees, paid expenses, and paid out the net to each of the physicians? Is that the problem?
Yes, and the fact that what we're claiming was the unjust enrichment isn't just that. It's the additional benefit Dr. Saber gave himself he wasn't entitled to. He attributed expenses to Dr. Fremling that weren't Dr. Fremling's. He would attribute expenses that were solely his as 50-50 expenses. It was that was the unjust enrichment, and he did benefit dollar for dollar. That's the unjust enrichment. So, I mean, I think it's unfortunate Judge Ensor did what he did. I think we still have a legitimate unjust enrichment claim, and we still have a legitimate judgment there. But he did do what he did do. And, again, his order on this is just as cryptic. It's just that motion for post-trial relief denied. Court finds Dr. Saber and the corporation.
Okay, now let's make an assumption on your argument. Make an assumption on your argument that we disagree with you about whether alter ego has been proven.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you?
I think we have to go back to the trial court and have findings. Because I don't know, to address Judge Rischke's question.
You didn't ask for a remand prior to this for that purpose.
No, we didn't. But if that is the problem, if we don't have a sufficient record as to what the basis of the alter ego finding is, or the basis of finding that there is no unjust enrichment claim after all, even after the judge found that there was.
So you posit two theories here. One, that the corporation was undercapitalized, and you base that on this fee arrangement where they take in the gross fees, pay expenses, and pay out the net.
The corporation is merely used as a vessel.
Yeah, and undercapitalization has nothing to do with that. It has everything to do with how it was initially capitalized, according to my research. The fact that it's operating in some way has nothing to do with whether it's capitalized or not. The other theory is that he operated this skin care business in the offices and didn't share the expenses and the expenses and income was improperly allocated.
Half the expenses were attributed to Dr. Fremling and all the income was attributed to Dr. Saber.
Okay. By Dr. Saber.
Okay. The business that was solely his.
And again, he was using basis for piercing corporate veil. Is that all you have?
It would be the way that he operated the company for his own benefit, that he didn't maintain any of the usual corporate formalities for bringing money in. Again, it was just simply a device to split revenue coming in and expenses that were being attributed. And I see a distinction there. Perhaps okay. You don't.
Okay.
Could I talk about the surety?
Those are your two arguments. If you went back and made the argument to the trial court that I have presented sufficient evidence to pierce the corporate veil, those would be your two arguments?
They would.
Okay.
To the security issue, again, there's somewhat of a tortured history here, but the one thing I believe that the counsel's not discussing is that there is a remedy available under Rule 8 of the appellate rules. If you've got issues as to security after a judgment, there is a way to get in front of this court, and that's how you do it.
But he brought the orders here on appeal.
He brought the April orders here on appeal, but not the ones that are prior to that. That's our point.
Well, they're all in the hopper. Every pre-judgment order entered by the trial court is appealable on appeal.
These are post-judgment orders on security.
I know, but they're not post-judgment orders. That's either the January or February order. I think counsel said January is the final order. Are you agreeing with that?
On the January order on the claims for relief, I do, yes.
Okay.
But we're talking about the subsequent orders on the issue of bond.
Subsequent orders were included by a motions division order, as I recall.
I think the last two are the April ones. Not the ones that come in between those.
Not the second February order.
Right. The one, and we're talking a year or two later now, I think 2 years later, after the first appeal was sent back down.
Right.
This thing gets very confusing. Even I'm confused, and I lived through this. But
well, that's why three perfectly good minds, and I don't count myself among them, struggled with this for most of the day yesterday.
It's been troubling for everybody.
Do you want to enlighten us at all on what we have jurisdiction over and what we don't?
Well, I don't think you have jurisdiction over a number of issues as to security. First of all, I'd like to comment on the point about posting security on behalf of both defendants. I think counsel admitted that Dr. Fremling originally did that. He tried to say it was a mistake of his counsel. Actually, I don't think that's true. I think what happened is Dr. Saber didn't inform his old counsel he intended to file bankruptcy. They ended up being one of the major creditors in his bankruptcy. And so they just simply filed what they believed they were supposed to file. And that clearly was security on behalf of both defendants. Now, we also have an appeal that was wrongly filed on the part of Dr. Saber. As you know, Judge Richman, Saber PC had already filed a Chapter 7 proceeding. Dr. Saber can't represent it. Only the trustee can. He went ahead and filed the appeal anyway, and we finally had to contact the trustee to say, is this legit? The trustee contacted Dr. Saber's attorney and said, you can't do this. Now,
how could they file security on behalf of a bankrupt?
Because they filed it before the bankruptcy was filed.
But there were orders and filing postings after that, weren't there?
Well, we obtained relief from stay for the entirety of this case. So I don't think so. I think this case is back in the state courts. Everything was back in the state courts because there was relief from stay. It's a good question, but there was a relief from stay that was issued, and it was very broad. So the security was posted on behalf of both. And it was originally posted in the form of the house. We objected to Rule 121, I think it's 1-23, which is the adequacy of security, maybe 122, the adequacy of security rules. And a deed to a house is not one of those the rule really, really envisions. It envisions a letter of credit, a cash deposit. And so we originally argued that it's not fair for Dr. Fremling to have to go through the process of foreclosure to realize on his security something better should be posted. So Dr. Saber did post on behalf of both defendants.
This was a warranty deed. It's not a deed of trust. It's a warranty deed. He gets title to the house. He doesn't go through foreclosure.
Well, we would still have to go through
an eviction proceeding.
We would. I mean, you're right. I'm sorry. We would have to go through a number.
I mean, the deed is a warranty deed to the clerk of the court. There's going to be no foreclosure on that.
But the rule doesn't recognize it. That was our concern. It doesn't. It's not one of the things that the rule actually recognizes. A letter of credit, it does recognize. And a letter of credit.
Real estate's put up for supersedious bond regularly. I did it myself in practice. Not my own real estate, you understand, but I mean real estate put up that value exceeds, appraised value exceeds. It's done all the time.
Well, anyway, we
objected to the house. I understand
yeah,
that.
We wanted
a letter of credit, and he provided you with a letter of credit.
That's right.
You kept the house.
Well, what happened is, in the meantime, the attorney's fee award was entered. This was after the letter of credit was posted, and then he wanted to pull the deed, and we said no because the judgment's now higher. And the trial court agreed with that because the judgment, in fact, was then higher. We had relief from stay, and it was posted on behalf of both. Now, I'd like just to comment on a couple things if I could. I've only got a couple minutes left. Back to the alter ego issue. We have also made the argument about judicial estoppel that Dr. Saber is stopped judicially from bringing that up. And I'd like to point out one thing in particular in that regard. They are still, Dr. Saber is still arguing the voluntary payment rule. Now, his premise of the voluntary payment rule is that Dr. Fremling voluntarily paid these expenses and voluntarily kept whatever he got in the net as a party to the contract. Well, if that's true, then Dr. Saber would have to have been a party to that contract as well because he was receiving the very same thing. Dr. Fremling can't be the only physician party to this agreement. If, in fact, we have an agreement, and there's a number of things.
What do you mean he can't be the only party, the physician party to the agreement? Dr. Saber owns the corporation.
He does.
The corporation contracted.
And
Dr. Saber, under that scenario, is not a party to the agreement.
And the record at trial was that Dr. Saber was agreeing to the very same thing. He was agreeing as an individual mm-hmm. to the very same system. Mm-hmm. Now, either he gets his as a corporate distribution, which was never the evidence, or he is under the exact same compensation system that Dr. Fremling is under. And, again, I'll be the first to admit, this is confusing. I wish it was much more clear. But we believe that Dr. Saber has taken a number of positions in this case that have stopped him from arguing that alter ego doesn't apply. He never pled corporate formality as a defense. I don't recall which one of you asked.
Everybody in this case, including the judge, have changed their positions and moved around quite a bit. Dr. Saber's not the only one.
Well, the judge obviously changed his position between his original judgment and the second judgment. And I think rightly so, were trying to defend a judgment we had in hand mm-hmm. on unjust enrichment. We took the position we took. Now, if the trial court is insistent that there is a judgment based on alter ego, I believe the facts support it. And I don't think it has to be pled. It's an equitable remedy. And if the evidence supports it, then we should be entitled to judgment on that basis as well. I think I'm out of time.
Well, no, you're getting close, but we're going to ask you another question.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm going to ask you another question.
Go ahead.
My question goes back to the security.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember, opposing counsel said, well, there's actually two different times when the security was pledged, and then there was an intervening event, the appeal was dismissed, and then there was a necessity of repledging some sort of security, at which point Dr. Saber took a different position with respect to whom the security would apply to protect
I think what you might be referring to is that the letter of credit was going to expire. And we asked for the court to either tap it or order that a new one be put in place. I think that may be what you're referring to. That's when we realized that the appeal on behalf of Sabre PC was improper and the maintaining of it was improper. Now, if that appeal had not been filed, we actually would have had a right judgment we could have collected on under that security.
Against the PC.
Against the PC.
Which was already then in bankruptcy.
We had relief from stay. Now, what would have happened to the award? I don't know. If it would have went over across the street, I don't know that. But I don't.
Is there relief from stay in the file?
Is there relief from stay in the file? I believe it's in the record, yes.
Okay.
It should be. It should be attached to a number of the motions in the file. I'm sure you have it. I can't quote you a page, but it's in there.
To get back to my original question, I thought that where you started out was, wait a minute, the mix-up on this appeal and being dismissed and then having to reinstate it was pretty much brought about by Dr. Sabre, who initiated a premature appeal, and then the Court of Appeals decides that, no, there's no jurisdiction over it yet. And then Dr. Sabre reinitiates the appeal, and I thought that you were heading towards the position, maybe I'm wrong, but I thought you were saying, no, that was not two separate appeals, two separate events, therefore you don't get to look at the security as discontinued and then a new security. I thought you were saying is, no, it's one continuous event, and people don't get to change their mind.
No, our position is that the security secures the judgment we received from the trial court. And what that does under Rule 62A, or the Rules of Civil Procedure, it disallows us from pursuing execution. And we were disallowed to do that while security was in place. So we were simply stating, this needs to stay in place. I don't think there was much of an issue about that when the first appeal was dismissed. That really came up when the letter of credit was coming to cancellation, which was about a year ago.
On what basis would the court have for calling on the letter of credit at the time it was about to expire? On what basis, what legal authority does it have to execute on that?
Well, there was a judgment.
On appeal.
On appeal by Dr. Sabre, but not by Sabre PC. Sabre PC was never validly in front of you. Dr. Sabre cannot have his attorneys file an appeal on behalf of an entity that has a Chapter 7 trustee. The Chapter 7 trustee is the only person who can do that. That appeal was never filed. Legally, it was never filed.
So what was the condition of the letter of credit that was met, that a final judgment had been
entered? Final judgment had been entered. And
you could have done that long before then.
No, because there was an appeal outstanding. That's what was being secured against. But the minute APS did not have a valid appeal, APS would be sitting there with a judgment against it, which we could collect, which we would have full rights to cash, letter, credit against.
Didn't you just say that happened when they filed bankruptcy? There was no valid appeal given the fact that they were in bankruptcy. You just said that a minute ago.
Yeah, our point is that this court should look at that as an estoppel factor against Dr. Sabre, because he, again, is using Sabre PC. He has his own individual device to do whatever he wants to do with it, even though it's in bankruptcy and even though he legally cannot do anything with it because he voluntarily put it in front of a trustee.
I want to go back to the first judgment.
Okay.
If he hadn't appealed that, it would have become final and you could have collected on it, right?
If it hadn't been appealed by the appellant.
If it hadn't been appealed, the one in 2007, yes. On the unjust enrichment, if he had not appealed that, it would have become a final judgment, the jurisdiction of this court over it notwithstanding, and you could have collected on it. So he had to appeal that order, or you would have collected on it.
Well, what would have been appealed would be Judge Ensor's amended judgment, since that was done on a Rule 59 motion. I think that's a correct reading of the procedure.
Well, the one in 2007 that was...
Right, there are actually two. That's the reason I'm getting a little confused.
Okay, but I mean, the two orders, whatever there were in 2007, he appealed, and the corporation perhaps appealed.
If they hadn't
appealed that, they would have become a final judgment, unappealable and collectible.
That's correct.
Okay, that's correct. All I have. Thank you, sir.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
Well, we're really extending our stay.
You like it here.
Thank you.
think I can clarify an awful lot of this confusion, probably not in 2 minutes, I regret to say. Alter ego, there is no need to remand a case for findings on a claim that was never litigated, not just not pled, never mentioned, never litigated, and especially a claim that we never mounted a defense to because it was never in the case. Why would you enter findings on a claim that we never had the opportunity to dispute these characterizations and these handful of facts that we're talking about now on alter ego liability? Was never in the case. I'm 99% sure that counsel has his facts wrong on the timing of this. There is an oral entry of judgment by the trial court. We then file a motion saying, wait, judge, you can't enter judgment against both of us except on an alter ego theory. There is the disclaimer, we've never relied on it. There is the handwritten ruling, alter ego. Then there are findings of fact and conclusions of law written, entered by the trial court, that we proposed. We don't say anything about alter ego or anything else, and the judge handwrites joint and several liability. That's the sequence there. In terms of security, we have three arguments on this, okay? It's the bond, substituting the letter of credit substituting for the deed, number one. Number two, improperly requiring Dr. Saber to submit a renewed letter of credit on behalf of a second judgment debtor. And the third argument is when this court said no final judgment, we should have had all the security returned. Of those three issues, as it relates to the jurisdictional question, it's only the latter that implicates any jurisdictional question, because it is the April 3rd, 2009, what we call operative security order that the motions panel has already ruled is part of this appeal. That is the only order that rules that the deed was pledged on behalf of both Dr. Saber and the corporation to account for the increased judgment, notwithstanding the letter of credit substitution. And it's the order that requires Dr. Saber to file the renewed letter of credit on behalf of both judgment debtors. So whatever confusion there is on jurisdiction, and there's a lot of security orders involved in this case, there is no question about the April 3rd order. And our two main arguments on the errors with security stem directly and solely from the April 3rd order.
Well, you're right, counsel. You couldn't do it in 2 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we thank both counsel for their briefs and argument. It is a very difficult case, somewhat of a quagmire indeed, but we will take it under consideration. It will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.